without trying to cut everybody off, it occurs to me that we've got a good share of the time here on the 1 and 10. I wonder if you would be able to give a brief outline on Section 2 dealing with partial responsibility, because that also has features of it in common with Section 1.
Before he answers that, Judge, I asked a couple of questions.
Sure.
Number one, did the subcommittee give any consideration to the split hearing procedures of California, and two, to the proposal, and maybe adopted in some jurisdictions, of psychiatrists appointed by the court to get away from the competing psychiatrist situation? Were those considered?
Professor Platt, why don't you respond to that?
The answer is yes to both questions, General Thornton. I think the feeling of the subcommittee examined the bifurcated trial system, the split trial system of California and the few other states that have it. We discussed it. We read some articles about the California system written by Jeffrey Hazard and another. Hazard, of course, is known to Oregon here for a few years. But it was commissioned by a commission in California to study that system, and they concluded that it was an ineffective system. It caused longer trials, more complicated trials, and ultimately settled the problem no better than the single trial, and they recommended against the system. The trend throughout the United States is away from bifurcated trials. Some states years and years ago went to them and have since gone back. And one of the reasons is because of this section dealing with partial responsibility in Section 2. Very briefly, what this section covers is the situation where a defendant would not qualify under Section 1, that is, would not be mentally diseased or defective so as to qualify for a complete defense of insanity. He's charged with murder in the first degree. He does not enter a plea of insanity, but instead introduces evidence by experts to show that because of a mental disease or defect, he was unable to form the necessary premeditation or intent required by the law, the mens rea, for the crime charge, that is premeditated first-degree murder. He is not saying, however, that I'm not guilty of something else. He is saying, in effect, you cannot convict me, ought not to convict me, of the murder in the first-degree charge. You ought to, or you may, convict me of a lesser-included offense, murder in the second degree, in other words. Now, this applies to any crime that is defined with an element of knowledge or purpose within the legal definition of the crime. It does not apply in the situation of intoxication. There'll be a separate section on intoxication in the Oregon new Oregon Code, and it's treated separately in the Model Penal Code. But at any rate, where the mens rea is not that which is charged because of the person's mental disease or defect, we are allowing him to bring in experts in an attempt, it makes it relevant, in other words, that the evidence be brought in to show that he has a lesser mens rea or is incapable of the mens rea charge. Now, the present status in Oregon of this particular rule is undetermined in the sense that our Supreme Court, as near as I can determine, has never been asked directly to rule on the subject. It has touched it indirectly a number of times, as noted here in the comment following, but has not held squarely one way or the other. It is our observation in subcommittee that on practice in the Oregon courts, partial responsibility does exist as a matter of fact, and that evidence of psychiatrists is pretty well allowed, it is generally allowed, in this kind of a situation. So I think we are recognizing formally what does now exist in fact, and the subcommittee, I believe, agrees that this is a justifiable and useful provision, in that it attempts to make the law, the definition of crime, more responsive to the culpability of the individual defendant. The stress here, of course, is on subjectivity rather than the old objective rule that the man is intends all the consequences of his act. This allows him to say, subjectively, I was unable to form the necessary element of purpose or knowledge in the crime, and therefore, if you convict me, it must be of a lesser offense. Now, I would go on to say that there is a little problem here that's been recognized in the draft I believe it's the following section. At any rate, it's possible under a situation like this for a defendant to be so convincing with his psychiatric testimony that the jury will acquit him of any crime. Well, the subcommittee was concerned with that situation. In other words, the jury just takes it into its own hands and says, not only is he not guilty of a lesser included offense, we feel so sorry for him, or we were so convinced that he just couldn't form any kind of criminal intent, that we find him not guilty, period. Now, of course, this does not invoke the machinery for dealing with him by allowing the judge under our existing law or under Article or Section 1 to commit him to the state hospital. The section following, I believe it's Section 3, would provide that in that kind of a situation, and it would be rare, it's recognized as a real rarity, but in that situation, the trial judge himself may act as the civil committing agent, that he may, on the basis of the evidence presented, institute the civil commitment procedures himself so that it need not go into the probate court system presently existing under Chapter 426. It was felt that the trial judge, if this system is going to be adopted, the trial judge, who knows what the situation is, ought better to conduct this kind of a hearing for civil commitment. Of course, this would guarantee to society and to the community, which is now extending a more subjective, liberal defense to a defendant, that one who does escape on this rarity of a not guilty version would be subjected or would be at least susceptible to a commitment procedure that would guarantee, presumably, the continuing safety of society from a dangerous kind of individual.
What section,
that's George? Section 8.
Is it 8? I'm
eight.
Sorry.
Eight.
It's Section 8. You can see, getting back to the bifurcated trial system, California's problem has been this way. If you say, we'll try the defendant for his guilt on the act, this is an ambiguity in that you can't find him guilty in the sense unless you examine his culpability, his mens rea. So that in a sense it's impossible to separate the guilt, the mens rea, from the act, whether he actually did the act. And then on top of that complication, the partial responsibility doctrine, which is in effect in California and, as I say, pretty well in effect practically speaking in Oregon, you're going to be litigating the same question even on a bifurcated trial system on the question of partial responsibility. Insanity taken out of the case, you still must hear on the question of his act whether he did that act as charged, whether he had the mens rea capable of that particular charged act. The result, the testimony is duplicated from one trial to the next pretty well. The complications are not, at least it's been California's experience, are not solved by splitting the trial. It's a very engaging prospect to say, we'll try him this way on this particular occasion and then decide in a separate hearing insanity.
Of course, the supporters of that doctrine in California think it's the greatest thing in the world, too. They're divided, as perhaps they are here. And actually, when they first determine whether he's guilty of the act, what they're really determining is whether the act was performed,
right,
not really the guilt.
Mm-hmm. In some states that have that system, they actually call it guilt.
Whether he committed the act.
They do call it guilt in California.
Yeah. Well, and that's
it isn't what they mean.
No, yeah. That isn't what they do.
We had a question come up, and it was an impeachment of a guy that had been found guilty and then not guilty by reason of insanity, whether you could impeach him on account of a conviction. And it was quite a touchy question. Because
mm-hmm.
They use that word guilt.
Could you?
No.
Well, it's still
stopped him from it anyway.
The constitutionality of the split trial is still in doubt. It's never, some states have said it's unconstitutional for some of these reasons that you're talking about. The Supreme Court of the United States, I don't believe, has ever been asked about the subject, but I have grave doubts about its constitutionality as a matter of law. As long as we subscribe to the concepts of mens rea and culpability.
Yeah. Well, I would take it from this Sirhan case that the judge apparently has some discretion in line
that
bifurcated trial.
Isn't the discretion they're talking about down there whether they have a separate jury in the second phase? I think that's what they're
I think you're right, Bruce.
Probably is it.
Your
modesty perhaps
jury.
Precluded you from mention of your comments in here about the so-called impartial witness, which at least to me were very persuasive.
Well, those are not my comments. I can't take credit for them. That's the model penal code. I'm sorry, it's Professor Goldstein's summation the criticism of the so-called expert, impartial expert system. That is set out here at length. Very briefly, it is that it places too much credibility on one psychiatrist because he is the court psychiatrist, and the defendant is prejudiced because of the fact that the jury says, well, this judge has appointed this doctor, therefore the doctor must be right because he doesn't belong to either party, and they'll tend to believe him. And we know, and I think all you psychiatrists here will agree, that that just isn't the case, that psychiatrists legitimately and validly differ about an individual case. That, for one reason, is why the Oregon has not adopted and why the subcommittee agreed to stay away from that system. There are other reasons, and I would refer you to the comments, the particular
might
section.
I say about that?
Beg pardon?
Might I say a couple words about that?
Sure.
A couple times, psychiatrists in Oregon have presented a bill in the legislature to embody this impartial expert witness deal, but ours was always on this basis, that if both the defense and the prosecution agreed on one psychiatrist, there could be one. But if not, then the judge would appoint one, the prosecution would appoint one, the defense would appoint one, and you would have this panel of three in order to get away from this matter that you brought up here, putting too much on the basis of one.
And the three would endeavor to express one opinion to the court?
Yeah, I think...
They could express one, or they could express...
Three.
Several.
Mm-hmm.
Or six.
one of the additional problems is the problem with cross-examination. In effect, you're cross-examining the court, and this just doesn't work very well. It's the court's witness that you're cross-examining, and this is a bad system also, if you want to challenge that kind of report. Even on a panel basis, the criticism is still raised that it's just too much credibility by operation of closeness to the bench itself to be allowed in an adversary system.
Are there other comments on the partial responsibility? I'd like to mention something here. I understand that this partial responsibility section does not include cases of intoxication.
That's correct. That's correct.
I think there is one type of intoxication which diagnostically we specify as pathological intoxication, which might better fit here than under the other section. Being unfamiliar with the other section, I'm on dangerous ground. But this is essentially a psychotic reaction of very brief duration caused by a hypersensitivity to alcohol, and accompanied usually by violent behavior and always with a total organic type of amnesia or lack of memory for the acts.
I would reply to that by saying that the section on intoxication has not yet been the subject of study of any of the subcommittees yet of the commission, but it has been in the back of the mind certainly of this subcommittee. Model Penal Code treats exactly the problem that you're raising by defining pathological intoxication and keeping it in the intoxication section. The effect, by the way, is the same as under the insanity test. When pathological intoxication is proved, as defined in that section, very much along the lines that you've indicated, it's a complete defense.
I see. Thank you.
May I interrupt here just once more and suggest that in your section on alcohol, this be so worded that it include a few other things, because there are already persons pleading not guilty on the basis that they were under the effect of amphetamines, LSD, barbiturates, and various things like that. And again, they were taken voluntarily, and it would seem to me that the same should apply there as applies to alcohol, and that the section should be worded to include.
I would expect that if we enact a partial responsibility rule, I would expect the major use of it would be in burglary and this sort of thing, where the responsibility is sought to be diminished because of either alcohol or narcotics. And with the current rise in narcotics use, I would think that probably quite a bit of use would be sought to be made of it, because it's a
Of course, the use of, the difference is basically here that the use of alcohol or narcotics is not generally recognized as a disease. Therefore, it doesn't qualify under the mental disease or defect aspects of partial responsibility as a doctrine. That's why it's treated separately.
I see.
And I would also respond that the Model Penal Code section, and I think all modern sections on intoxication, and I would certainly hope the Oregon section, would not be limited to alcohol. As a matter of fact, intoxication is defined in the code as the introduction of substances into the body.
Which however, these cases that I mentioned to you of crimes committed because a person were depressed and so forth, I would think those would come under the partial responsibility thing there, because a depressive reaction is a mental illness.
That's right.
I just had a question for my own information. Use of alcohol is not illegal. I mean, if a person is 21 or over, but it seems to me that there are laws against the use of drugs, you know, illegally obtained and so forth. Would that still fit into partial responsibility if somebody's on heroin, for instance, which is a felony, and then would this still be exculpating in some way,
sure,
partially? In other words, the commission of a crime leading to exculpation and the commission of a subsequent crime.
You'll have two trials.
First, is he correct? Is the use of drugs a crime?
Oh, yeah. Possession.
Possession is.
Well, that's different, though.
Well, that's different. But
say
to answer his question, it seems to me that the question is the forming of an intent. The mens rea, and it doesn't matter whether your mental condition was arrived at legally or illegally.
That's right.
Would seem to me to answer it.
What about the felony murder rule?
There isn't any felony murder.
Well, I mean, assume that he was charged with first-degree murder. He wanted to exculpate it because he was under the influence of drugs at the time he committed the crime. Would or would not the felony murder rule attach if it could be shown he had committed a felony by being under the influence of drugs at the time he committed the murder?
Well, the only case we have is on that in Oregon, the Jensen case, where the defendant made that exact argument that he couldn't be held for felony murder, which is first degree, that because of his inability to form the intent to commit murder, premeditated murder, that was his argument, that he had to reduce to second. And the court observed that the partial responsibility doctrine did not apply in this case, that he must make his argument to the crime that underlays the felony murder.
Yeah.
In this case, I think it was robbery.
Robbery, yeah.
And in that case, he's got to argue that he couldn't form the intent for that, and therefore it was reduced to a misdemeanor, and then he couldn't be held, of course, on the felony murder rule, because that follows the felony.
Or that it'd be second-degree murder.
Yes.
Because the first-degree felony murder only applies
That's as close as our court, I think, has come to facing having to make a decision, but it was a negative decision and certainly did not say that partial responsibility does not apply in Oregon. I said it was misapplied by the defendant in that case.
Let me ask another question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. You're talking, George, about partial responsibility attaching in these specific intent crimes like burglary, whatever. So you show that he did, that partial responsibility does attach, and so instead of finding him guilty of burglary, you find him guilty of petty larceny?
Criminal trespass, or some lesser included offense, of course. I don't know what it would be.
I can see the application or the applicability of partial responsibility insofar as rape, maybe, or murder, reducing it from first degree or second degree, or from...
Well, it wouldn't work in rape because this is the old general intent crime, and there is no element of purpose by definition in the crime of rape. It can be committed recklessly.
What do you do with grand larceny? A guy steals $5,000, and partial responsibility attaches, so you reduce it to petty.
That's not one of the felony murder.
You don't need a specific intent to commit grand larceny.
Well,
yes, you do.
Yes,
it depends
on
the element of the crime.
You have an intent to permanently deprive, but the value is not an element.
That's
there.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a specific intent crime.
Yeah,
and
where the lesser included offense is also a specific intent crime, you wouldn't have.
Yeah, it couldn't be petty larceny either, because the same intent would apply to petty larceny. So it would be a lesser crime. It would be an assault and battery, or a battery, or a trespass, or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
if he touched the person when he took the money. And
apparently.
Or it's possible now that there's no lesser included offense and that the jury would have to acquit, and in which case the judge who is faced with a person he sees as dangerous may proceed civilly to committee. If he feels, in, on medical advice of the psychiatrist, that the person ought to have treatment through our civil commitment procedures.
But if, on the other hand, it wouldn't apply to taking and using, would it? Which is one of the crimes that most often involves people that are suffering from some kind of a mental defect, because it's not a specific intent.
Well, no,
crime.
No, I don't think there's any specific intent.
No, it would not apply.
So it wouldn't apply there.
Perhaps if they did it while they were drunk, they'd have the intoxication. Intoxication, of course, you realize, is exactly like partial responsibility. As a matter of fact, the partial responsibility laws have stemmed directly from the intoxication concept. Intoxication lowers the mens rea to a lesser included offense, just like this does. So they're very similar. One stems from what is recognized as a mental disease or defect, partial responsibility, and the intoxication stems from that which is not now, at least in the law, recognized as a mental disease or defect.
Can I respond to Dr. Voice's question earlier, just to regress a minute here? You ask about drugs on this intoxication question. The model penal code affirmative defense of intoxication would not apply if it's self-induced. I mean, if they're self-induced, whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever it happens to be, the way I read this section of it. This is an affirmative defense if the intoxication is not self-induced or pathological. Under those two circumstances, it would be an affirmative defense.
I don't understand. That was something I couldn't get straightened out here, this business of affirmative and negative defense.
Well, the question had come up about how intoxication would fit into this, and this would be covered by a separate section. And I think your question was, well, would this apply to...
Would it apply to the commission of a... You know, I was asking whether it would apply to the commission of an offense with a subsequent offense. This was...
Yeah. But the model penal code formulation set out that whether it were narcotic drugs or alcohol or some other substance, if it were self-induced, in other words, if this was a voluntary thing, this would not be a defense.
Pathological intoxication. Still, intoxication, even though self-induced, of course, can be a defense on the specific element aspect.
On the responsibility.
Yeah, where the purpose or knowledge is an element, but not on recklessness. The law now stops there, and the model penal code stops there, too.
Well, as I read the model penal code, that part of it doesn't materially differ from the present Oregon law.
That's correct.
On intoxication.
That's correct.
Even though I think most everybody realizes that intoxication is one of the lousiest defenses you can use.
Juries don't agree with it.
They don't buy it.
I think we probably should hear a good stop.
Are we at a good stopping point, Professor?
Oh, I've already gone on at length anyhow. I apologize for
what's a good time?
Monopolizing.
About 1:30.
1:30 would be all right, then.
Did you make the length of time?
No, I didn't.
Lunch would be a cappella.
A cappella. Wherever you wish to go. I suggest probably the Marion Hotel is as good as any.
Earlier, Jeff Sloan, down at the end there, who's been especially helpful to our subcommittee and to the commission for faithful attendance and real help in suggestion. And also, we have two district attorneys here today, Lou Williams from Columbia County and Don Blensley from Yamhill County. And we also have Bruce Rockin, who got here just in time, the man in the red shirt, who is the chairman of the Criminal Law Committee of the State Bar. And though I didn't call on you gentlemen earlier this morning, please feel free to join in the discussion whenever you feel you ought to, because we especially welcome all the help we can get from your suggestions. Are we still on partial responsibility, Professor Platt? Or
I suppose we're still on it.
Should we also gradually work into the question of the burden of proof, because this is also really an inherent part of the problem, and one on which the subcommittee had some mixed feelings.
trying to find the section so I can... Section 4, perhaps.
Section 3.
Okay. We touched on the burden of proof just fleetingly with respect to discharge decisions under Section 10, but the issue of burden of proof arises much earlier in that when the defendant files his plea, or that is when he files notice that his defense will be mental disease or defect, the statute in Oregon now provides that the burden is on the defendant to prove his insanity by a preponderance of the evidence. The subcommittee, after much discussion, decided to leave the law as it now is with respect to burden of proof. And I think that this is the only area in which I had any major dissent with the subcommittee. I set out what I believe to be the case for shifting the burden of proof on the question of sanity to the state, rather than leaving it now where it is. I don't want to open the argument again because
it might be interesting to observe in this regard that is it Colorado, Professor Platt?
Mm-hmm.
Colorado has recently ruled, the Colorado Supreme Court, that the Colorado statute which imposes the burden of proof on a defendant in insanity cases is unconstitutional as a matter of due process. And just recently, and somewhat along the same line, although you can distinguish the two, the Eighth Circuit has ruled that an Iowa statute which imposes the burden of, upon a defendant on alibi, again by a preponderance of the evidence, that statute is also unconstitutional. And I think we ought to be aware in discussing this section, namely burden of proof and insanity, that that there probably is what could be fairly described as a growing trend toward doing away with any burden on the defendant on constitutional grounds.
Didn't we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision a number of years ago that held to the contrary?
It was in the early 50s.
Stronger case?
It was in the early 50s, and of course the case arose in Oregon, Leland versus Oregon, and the United States Supreme Court said the states are left to their own, and it is not a question of due process. And they may choose to put the burden where they feel that policy in the state best dictates.
Of course, at that time, the burden here was beyond reason.
Yes. It was changed to lessen that, but despite that United States Supreme Court case, it's my feeling that if that case arose now in the United States Supreme Court, I think, and it's purely one man's judgment, that the opinion would be different, that the United States Supreme Court would find, as a matter of due process, that insanity is elemental, that it does go to the mens rea, that it is a part of the element of the crime that the state must prove, just as it must prove the man's guilt, rather than forcing him to prove his innocence. Now, the United States Supreme Court in 1952, I guess it was, when that case was decided, did not subscribe to that, although Justice Frankfurter, in dissent, very clearly subscribes to that view, or did at that time, that it is important to the defendant that it's a matter of a question of his innocence, his mental intent, whether he was sane or not, and therefore must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt by the state. Now, when I drafted the original article here, the language read that the defense of insanity was an affirmative defense, which has the effect under the definitions of the Model Penal Code of allowing the defendant to enter. He must raise the issue. If he doesn't raise the issue of insanity, the state has the burden. That is, the state has the presumption that he is sane and they need not introduce evidence at all. But if the defendant introduces some evidence on the issue, and the amount of evidence would be then left to the courts of Oregon to decide what some evidence amounts to, then the burden of not only proceeding, but also the burden of persuasion would shift back to the state beyond a reasonable doubt. As the subcommittee did not agree with me on that.
I think the subcommittee's feeling, and I don't remember which meeting this was at, but I think we had a truncated membership present at the time, but the subcommittee's feeling, I think, was that with the presumption of sanity and the proper allocation of the burdens in a case, that it still would be unwise to depart from the traditional rule of at least an Oregon traditional, that you impose the burden on the defendant to prove his case. And as I recall, and members of the subcommittee that were present at the time were all in favor of retaining the present system. I think it would be helpful here if we have some expression of opinion. Perhaps the doctors would be good enough to give a suggestion on that. Do you think, Dr. Smith, for example, that it defendant ought to have the burden on this issue?
Jim, before you go into that, why don't you distinguish the Oregon's already relaxed from the beyond a reasonable doubt to a preponderance, so that they'll get the full picture.
Essentially, the burden on the defendant is he must prove insanity by a preponderance, which is defined customarily as the greater weight of the evidence, as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, which is defined customarily as proof to a moral certainty, or proof that would justify action in the most important of one's affairs. This sort of thing is the standard definition of beyond a reasonable doubt. So the burden on the defendant is less than that on the state as to the elements of the crime and so on. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, to this physician, it seems more a legal question than a medical one, but it would seem that if a defendant offered this defense, he would certainly have something to back it up in terms of an expert witness. And it would seem easier in that case to prove insanity than, I think you could almost always prove sanity, even in an insane person, if you observed him in a lucid interval. You could bring a witness in that said, well, you know, he made the right change at the cash register, or he went into the men's room instead of the ladies' room. I think you could prove sanity with any of us, far enough. So I think it's more illegal than that.
Do you have any comments, Dr. Boyce, on this aspect?
Well, I don't think it's, the way I feel about it, it's very much a legal question, but what Dr. Smith brought up here, though, raises again the issue that I keep coming back to, and that is, I think the function of the psychiatrist is to say what he knows about the person, what was going on at the time, and the relationship of this individual to the offense, and so I don't see that would, the psychiatric, a psychiatrist would really have anything to offer to that kind of question.
Dr. Butler, would you?
I have nothing to add.
Let me ask the two district attorneys who are here today, Lou or Don, do you have any comments that you think would be helpful on this aspect, or on anything else for that matter? Do you favor putting the burden on the defendant in insanity?
Can you pass that?
Yes. And those representing him are more often able to have access to his complete background, his associates.
Talked about going in the ladies' room.
I have known no cases where placing this burden on him has resulted in a verdict that was not patently correct. If you turn it around and you notice the defense, then and some evidence that has behaved in a bizarre fashion, or some expert testimony that he would fit into one category or another, comes the question now, how do I prove this? They can bring in witnesses which perhaps are not really persuasive, not exceptionally persuasive, but they have access to them. And the state will ordinarily, the 10 large bodies, will not have access to the same degree that it could persuade an impartial mind that he was sane, especially if the crime involves a very bizarre one. And if there is an unwritten presumption that the fellow wouldn't do that if he went crazy.
Is sanity or insanity statutorily defined?
No.
Don?
I think I'd agree somewhat with Lou. The procedural questions that would give, that would come about from something of that nature is what would bother me. You're talking about insanity at the time the crime was committed. And here I'd have to defer to the doctors as to the difficulty of arriving at a decision in that light, unless you have a possibility, say, of forcing the defendant to disclose to the psychiatrist information which he might have, which would be involved in the question of what he did or didn't do as far as the act is committed. Here you're not only, in having a single trial, you're not only trying the issue of insanity, you're trying the issue of whether or not he committed the act. And when you're doing them both at the same time, and if you have the burden of proving that he's sane at that time, yet don't have the concurrent ability to discuss the matter with the defendant, it seems to me that you're not coming up with a just and right answer. And what it doesn't matter who we're putting the burden on, what you're striving to come up with, to my way of thinking at least, is really, is he or is he not insane, depending on definition of insanity that you come up with. And if you don't come up with the right answer, I think is the ultimate question. And it seemed to me it'd be much harder to come up with the right answer by putting the burden on the state.
You'd say in effect then that the burden should be upon that person who is in the best position to produce the evidence.
It seems to me, unless you take away his Fifth Amendment privilege, which you can't do.
If you chip
that situation where it'd be easier for the defendant.
If you chip the burden to the state, would you still require the defendant to give notice to the state that the defendant intended to rely on insanity as a defense?
You would under that.
Yes, I would. May I ask a psychiatrist something I think that is within your purview to answer? In Oregon, you may know, Shepard versus Bowe decided that the state psychiatrist may not ask a defendant who is examining on behalf of the state any questions relating to the criminal act itself. That's now protected by the Fifth Amendment in this state. Can you, would you be able to determine if you were appointed by the state to examine this, the defendant, could you find other ways to arrive at a legitimate conclusion as to the mental condition of that defendant?
At the time of the commission of
yes.
the act, without asking about the details.
Without asking about the act itself. For instance, would you be able to observe the defendant during the trial, listen to the evidence, and make conclusions that would be valid?
Smith would say no.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't undertake the examination of anybody with those kind of prescriptions.
Why not?
I don't think that you can get a real evaluation of, and I go back again to my thesis, of what the meaning of the offense was and how it relates to this individual and this, what I think, you know, this concept of insanity, however we're going to define it. But that you have to know all that you can know, and if you can hide all kinds of things behind the crime, if you don't have to talk about the crime, then you don't know what's hidden back there, so to speak. On the other hand, if he has to talk about the crime, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to. It seems to me, if you examine somebody, that he's going to operate in a way to protect himself.
Is your answer then, Doctor, that actually you would not be satisfied with your conclusion if you were prohibited from discussing the actions surrounding the act, the crime itself?
If I didn't have control of the examination and how it was to be conducted, then I wouldn't be interested in conducting it.
Do you think that if you did conduct it under those circumstances, with those restrictions, that you'd be confident of your conclusions?
I don't think so.
Dr. Smith?
In answer to that, I think that this I think comes under your Section 7 after a while, isn't it? And I jotted down as notes when I was looking this over that the defendant when being examined by the state psychiatrist shall not be required to answer questions concerning his conduct at the time. And I noted that this information might be quite essential to constructing the so-called pres illness, as we designate it, or evaluating the patient's mental status at the time. Secondly, the matter of being entitled to have an attorney and or a psychiatrist present at the examination. Generally, I think this would be a great interference. In neither of these instances is this to say that it couldn't be done, because I've had to do it on a number of occasions, and I think it depends. For instance, out in Malheur County, I examined a defendant for the prosecution, and defendant's attorney insisted on being present. Well, he was present, but he kept his darn mouth shut and didn't interfere with the examination, either verbally or by nonverbal signals, and so I think things went as well in that instance as they might have had I been alone with the prisoner. But I think there would be occasions where I sure wouldn't want Dan Voice sitting in on one of my beds. So either way, but ideally we would rather do this on our own terms, in our own environment,
If you weren't able to ask him about the act itself, would you have much confidence in the conclusion?
It would diminish my confidence.
Dr. Butler?
I would agree. It would diminish my confidence in my conclusions, and certainly one would feel much more able to support a conclusion if you had more of the facts about the specific act. And you have to get the details about it before you can come to some way of evaluating what might be behind the act itself.
What about having another lawyer or another psychiatrist, present during the examination?
Well, if they would honor your wanting to do it without their interference or verbal or nonverbal participation in it, yeah, I think it would be all right. As a matter of fact, I often examine people with others present. The medical school is very common then.
Please, Mr. Carson.
Bruce, we didn't get around quite to you. Do you have any comment on this burden of proof thing?
Gentlemen, this is Wally Carson, lawyer from Salem, the representative new member of the commission.
Hi, Wally.
I think you know everyone, Dr. Smith, Dr. Voice, Dr. Butler, Dr. Sloan, Dave Cross, Don Hart, Bruce, John, and Don, Judge Burns.
Right.
Professor George Millett, the Attorney General.
Good. Hi, Wally.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
And our secretary.
Platt.
Platt.
Yeah, Platt.
Schizophrenic.
Platt.
I said Platt. Sociopath.
Ask Bruce Rothman again if he's got any suggestion on this question of should the burden of proof in insanity cases be on the defendant, or should it be on the state?
I'm inclined to think that it should be on the defendant, as the rule exists at this time. It's a workable rule. I think it prevents spurious offenses in this regard. And, generally, these matters don't come up in Multnomah County unless they generally come up when you have an indigent defendant, or there's a bizarre crime and evaluation is made, and the purposes for which the evaluation can be made under the existing law are quite limited. Consequently, as it works in Multnomah County, I can't speak for other counties, when the evaluation is made, the reports go automatically to the district attorney's office, which obviates any secret non-disclosure of evidence. I see no problem whatsoever. If there's a private evaluation made, of course, that is a different circumstance and a different bag. I think the problem in that regard, and the problem generally in the criminal law, in the area of discovery, is a vast problem. I don't see that problem from a district attorney's standpoint, particularly when you have an indigent defendant where there is a bizarre crime, because both of these go. I have had the unpleasant experience in Multnomah County of having a district attorney call a evaluating psychiatrist from the Oregon State Hospital in regard to representations made by my client, when it was determined that he was able to assist counsel and that he was not saying to call him in regard to representations made as a part of the history and in regard to his admissions to get around the confessions present rules that we have. The trial court, I mean, quite properly, excluded this testimony based on the attorney-client privilege, that this was privileged as I had requested it as his attorney, and this information was therefore privileged. But I see a real possibility here, and there are problems in that area. Particularly with a certain type of prosecutor.
Take that.
Well, I know.
Well, you exclude everybody present, don't you, Bruce? Yeah, okay.
I'd like to direct a question then to the district attorneys present, reversing the situation. Now we have Shepherd versus Bull. We haven't had it very long, so there might not be any experience with it yet, but the defendant, under the present statute, must prove the insanity by a preponderance, and he gives notice, and he comes in and goes to trial, and you come in under the State versus Phillips and say, we have a right to a psychiatrist. You get your psychiatrist appointed, I assume. You still do this? Or have you had occasion to do it yet, since Shepherd versus Bull? And what point I'm making is, the defendant puts on his evidence. How do you disprove it? How do you counter the defendant's evidence if your psychiatrist can no longer ask him about the crime? How do you get around this problem?
The ones I've had, the psychiatrist said that he didn't meet the legal requirements of being insane and they would function well in a structured environment, so I haven't had a problem yet.
Like jail.
You can see that the possible problem may come up just the other way around. You will be handicapped in not knowing about the defendant, whereas before Shepherd versus Bull, you had a right to ask him about the crime to counter the defendant's evidence. Or do you see this as a problem?
It's a problem, but it's there, and we have to function into it.
Of course, it seems to me that under Shepherd versus Bull, you'd simply exacerbate the problem by placing the burden on the state.
That's true, and I think we ought to recognize that. But I suppose I have no doubt that Shepherd versus Bull makes the state's burden much greater because it takes away information that was very valuable for a psychiatrist to know.
But the defendant can presumably pretty easily demolish the validity of the diagnosis by the state's man because he didn't ask him about this.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is minimized to a certain extent because by the time you get a guy to trial, you have facts to indicate the person is guilty. So oftentimes you do have a confession, you have a statement, or you have some facts at least that you can give a report to the psychiatrist. So even though he can't talk directly to the defendant, he has some. Which, of course, if defense psychiatrist might not if he didn't have the opportunity of having your report.
You
so he has a little bit more. It's obvious it's a problem.
You feel that wouldn't be enough, though, if the burden was yours?
I would have to, again, defer to the doctor's opinions, but I'm sure that it would tend to hurt the evaluation.
The assumption, then, is that the person who would invoke this would be guilty because otherwise... How could he refuse to talk about a defense that he didn't commit?
Well, that isn't correct because you have one trial and you try both issues at one trial.
Well, I think you've seen the problem as I see it, that this is not a question of insanity. It's a question of basic innocence or guilt. And I view the problem as a constitutional problem, and it disturbs me that we place the burden in this case on the defendant. In what I view, and certainly the United States Supreme Court has disagreed with me, and that's pretty good authority for disagreement, what I view as a question of due process.
If you had to examine him in regard to the question of insanity, and then he says, I refuse to talk about the offense, isn't that the same as saying...
Not legally.
Same as saying I must be guilty.
Yeah.
Dragged up.
I was saying you can examine me, but I won't talk about this thing.
Wow. I mean, how many other areas of law do you know where proving your negative is really required?
It's very limited, but I'm sure you're aware that placing the burden of any sort on a defendant is extremely rare also. In fact, I'm sure there must be one or two others, but can you suggest to me where the burden is on the defendant by a preponderance? Anyplace else in Oregon law?
The burden is on the state to prove that it was not self-defense if the question is raised by the defendant.
Well, for certain,
well,
that's just to create a reasonable doubt. There isn't a preponderance. I think in your narcotics, that it is by a prescription or within one of the exceptions of your chapter. I think there is a burden there on the defendant.
I'm interested to know that. I simply asked the question really to make the point that it is really rare to place any burden on a defendant in a criminal case.
Well, just because it's rare doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, though.
No, that's true.
Georgia's states are actually about evenly split on this question.
That's right. It's about half and half. I think Judge Burns has summed up what looks like to be the trend. The trend is away from it, I think. But by choice, not by necessity, not by legal necessity.
At least until the Colorado view is adopted by the College in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably Oregon's free to impose the burden on the defendant.
What is the basis of the federal rule? Is that a court rule, statute, or what?
As to burden in the federal
right.
system?
Right.
Yeah, it's a federal court rule. And that's an interesting anomaly. The United States Supreme Court acknowledged that the federal rule is opposite from the Oregon rule. In other words, the federal courts think the better policy is to allow is to place the burden on the state beyond a reasonable doubt. The United States Supreme Court said this is not constitutional. It's based on the inherent powers of the federal courts to make their own rule.
Anybody else have any comments on the burden of proof?
Well, it seems to me that the presumption of sanity should carry the state's case on that issue until there's been some evidence to the contrary. And there's where the question arises, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to me that it makes sense to require the state to prove the sanity by the carry the burden, or whatever that might be. Where
Don, you have any?
I agree. I think that the defendant is in the best position to go forward with evidence of insanity. I think we're talking about a different. Something different under the old rule when we're talking about evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the new rule that we have requiring the defendant to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence is a good rule. I think it's equitable. The defendant's in the best position to do it. It's workable. And I can't see anything at all wrong with it, practically or philosophically.
Well, I would add only, I don't want to extend the discussion. I think it's an interesting point, but I would want to point out to you, John, that I don't subscribe to always, I'm not entirely consistent, because when the Inchoate Crimes article reaches you, you'll find that I'm suggesting that in the cases of an attempt or a conspiracy or a solicitation where the defendant has withdrawn after the attempt has been complete or before the crime is completed, that he will have a renunciation defense, and I would place there the burden by a preponderance on the defendant. So I'm not devoted entirely one way, but I'm trying to single out this particular instance where I feel very strongly it ought to be on the state.
I think that this is one of the policy questions that we have to meet, and I think that it's legitimately raised and should be discussed, because all of us, or at least some of us, probably weren't aware that there was another route to go. So I'm grateful for it coming up, but I...
Justice Sloan, do you have any comment on this?
No.
Representative Frost?
Well, the only comment would be that I think we're in an area where theoretically we have two probably good opposing views, and I think that when we talk about preponderance of the evidence standard for the defendant, that we're making a very practical compromise and a workable one. The big, strong argument in favor of requiring the defendant to do something of this kind is the fact that he's the one who's in possession of the facts. We can't force a disclosure to the state. I think it's unfair then to shift that burden to the state.
And I think it's not too difficult to explain, and that's very important when you talk about a jury. It's easy to tell a jury, I think, and make them understand that it must be proven by the defense, by preponderance of the evidence. This is all, the only one thing. The rest of it's up to the state.
Anything else on the burden of proof? Well, that brings us, I guess, to the questions on notice. Do you want to outline that? Right.
I don't recall anything here that is substantially different than existing practice. The present statute requires, as you undoubtedly know, that when a defendant intends to inject insanity as a defense, although all he does is plead not guilty as a formal plea, he must enter a written notice at the time he enters his plea that he will rely on insanity as his defense. If he does not do it at that time, presently under the statute, if the court sees for good reason a good cause shown, he may give that notice later, or evidence may be admitted at the trial for good cause shown. That policy is continued pretty well under this statute with somewhat more economical language. Perhaps the difference here would be because of the existence now in this article of the partial responsibility defense, which is new. And in this situation, the subcommittee decided to require notice to the state when the defendant intends to raise partial responsibility. There was an alternative question here. If the defendant intends to bring in an expert witness is one situation, or where the defendant intends to rely on any kind of testimony other than expert witnesses is a different situation. The subcommittee decided that where the defendant is going to use lay testimony only, or his own testimony only, he need not give notice to the state, that this would not deprive the state or would not be an alarming to the state to put them on the technical defense or cause them difficulty. But where the defendant intends to use expert witnesses, and this would mean psychiatrists, psychologists, neurologists, anyone of that of the science, then he must give notice in the same manner as if he were pleading insanity as his defense.
We spent some time in subcommittee on this. Mm-hmm. I figured maybe we'd strike some sparks there. I wonder if either of the district attorneys who were present have any thoughts on this. In other words, this would mean in cases where partial responsibility was a defense that the defendant can surprise the state except where he does so with expert witnesses. Mm-hmm. If you want to state it in a slanted fashion.
Frank Knight, who was, of course, a district attorney, is not here today, responded in behalf sort of the district attorneys, and he said he was not concerned about lay testimony. That he would not feel surprised or disadvantaged by it, and he subscribed to the ultimate notice provision that was adopted in the subcommittee.
Jake Tanzer also expressed the same view, I think.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I have a question that may not be perfectly obvious, and I just don't see it. George, just in the sheer drafting of this, and in Section 4 says that no evidence may be submitted unless he has complied with Section 6,
mm-hmm.
and same with Section 5. And Section 6 says a defendant who is required under Sections 4 or 5 of this article give notice. Now, I don't read either Section 4 or 5 as requiring notice.
Well, I certainly don't intend that to be the case. The subcommittee did not intend that to be the case, and if it has happened, then the language ought to be clarified.
Well, you see, the thing is, by referring to Section 6, see, he must comply with Section 6,
mm-hmm.
which Section 6 does not of itself require notice. And there's no language that I see in any of these sections that actually says you have to give notice.
Well, I think this is a drafting. What you're suggesting is that 4 and 5 should read unless he is given notice in accordance with the provision of Section 6.
Right.
I think that would take care of it.
Yes, it's just purely a... Yeah. And as I say, it may be something that is not worthy of commenting, but it's just the way it seemed to me when I read it over.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest, I think possibly that, of course, they're welcome to stay, but if they wanted to leave, if we would look at Section 11, we invited the comments of the doctors here with respect to that, then perhaps they might be free to leave if they wish.
Okay, let us move to Section 11.
I think that's what that is.
37. Do you want to go into that?
Very briefly, this I think reflects pretty much what existing law is again, with perhaps some specificity that is not now in the law with respect to subparagraphs 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they're there only to make clear the kinds of examination or the issues that ought to be in the minds of the psychiatrist when they're talking to the person who is being examined by them.
Now, it seems to me that those 1, 2, 3, and 4 are exclusive, and I was just wondering if the staff has felt that there should be anything added or changed if needed.
My reaction is that they're intrusive enough.
Well, perhaps we could ask the question this way. Could you, upon examination, reach a conclusion with reasonable assurance in your own mind that we ought not to force anybody to trial who doesn't qualify under one of those sections, or who fails to qualify, let's say, under any one of them? I think what the subcommittee was trying to achieve was essentially to give as broad a scope as we could to the examiner, who essentially makes the decision now. I don't know of hardly any situation in which the court would override the examiner's decision on this issue of whether he's competent to stand trial. Dr. Boyce, do you have any comment on that?
I think this is that this is quite clear. These are the questions that we ask ourselves, and at least that I ask myself, and also that we were talking about in that panel a few weeks ago with the district court.
The same separation of the separation of these two issues. Makes.
And it would seem to me that this would include just about everything that you'd need to address yourself to make a reasonable decision as to whether somebody could proceed.
This was the subject in the panel in Judge Solomon's court?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So one of the major issues, anyway.
Jim?
Yes.
Is sub 3 looks new to me. I'm not that familiar with it, but
yes.
Is that redundant? Wouldn't that fall into 2 and 4 both?
I'll ask Professor Platt to respond to that.
Well, I would say in the first instance that if we made no change at all in existing law, that we'd probably be all right without any of the more specific references here. And it, viewed as you view it, it is possible to say that it is redundant to a certain degree. But I think what we ought to remember here is that this section is directed to psychiatrists and not to lawyers. Predominantly, the reason for this section is to tell the psychiatrist what the court needs to know. If it is redundant, then it does no harm in any way.
By being specific, we're not taking away from the others.
Well, I don't think so. In my opinion, I don't think we are. But I certainly could stand reversed on that one too. I think this covers what needs to be covers what subjects the psychiatrist needs to examine his patient on.
And I think it's valuable for that reason, that defining these things makes our job easier if we know what questions the court wants answered. A better position to answer.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
It occurs to me that 2, 3, and 4 are redundant, and when we talk about following the evidence or participating in the defense, we're really talking about being able to assist, such as we have in the present law now.
Mm-hmm.
I have some particular questions that I'd like to go into with Professor Platt later about the use of language a person can't be proceeded against as opposed to the present language, but let me ask Dr. Smith. Now, it's entirely possible that as a result of an examination you could conclude that this particular man might not be able to follow the evidence, while at the same time you could find that he could understand the nature of the proceedings against him and also be able to assist counsel. Isn't that right?
I don't see how you reach that conclusion.
Well,
how could he understand the nature of the proceedings immediately underway if he was unable to follow the evidence.
Well, if you had a hell of a scientific, complicated damn thing, I might not be able to follow it. But
that's the point.
But not as a result of
yes, that's the answer.
Yeah.
No, well, yeah, that's debatable. Right, that's an answer.
Yeah. Unless you're a defective, I don't think that's true.
That's one way you could really.
Well, he's defense minded.
Being tried.
Mm-hmm.
I simply can't follow the evidence.
Could I answer this in a sort of a reverse English fashion? I could think of a case where a man would be able to understand the nature of the proceedings against him, but on the other hand, would not be able to assist and cooperate with his counsel. For instance, a deeply depressed individual who felt that he was deserving of punishment and just consciously decided he wasn't going to assist his counsel.
All right,
or a defendant who felt that this son of a this fellow was court appointed and I don't like him and I'll be damned if I'm going to tell him these things. Fully aware of what he's charged with and what's going on and why that guy's up there in the black robe, but because of his paranoid suspiciousness, let's say, unable to assist his attorney. It would seem to me, I don't really understand the follow the evidence bit, but the other things, I think each has its usefulness.
Well, you said that you felt that this proposed revision was helpful because it defined the bounds within which you were to make your judgment. And I wanted to know what new dimension would be added to your examination, which would, by the inclusion of following the evidence, which might assist you in, or enable you to say that he's incompetent. And I
don't think it'd particularly add anything to the examination, but it might make it easier for us to communicate with the court if it were clearly defined what the court had in mind.
Dr. Boyd?
I have along the same line, and we were talking about this at lunch. A man who's delusional has in mind getting a maximum sentence, and he refuses to do anything to abrogate that, so that this is his goal. Now, does he, and so he can't assist in the sense of cooperating with his counsel in terms of defending himself against the charges. Is this included in here? Is this included in here? Is he then able to assist in his own defense or cooperate with his counsel, or does he have the freedom to his own to use the courts toward his own self-destruction? I don't.
In other words, he's able to, but he won't.
Well, no, that isn't the issue.
Because
he's not really able to, because of his delusion. I have.
How about the ones who were sentenced to the death penalty and instruct their attorney not to file an appeal? And this sort of thing.
Same
even
thing.
Even though we don't have it here anymore, but you read about this occasionally in other states.
Or where the death penalty is rescinded and the person commits suicide. These. And I think this is the same kind of thing.
Pardon? That makes the case moot.
Yeah. But I wonder about this. This came up in a case that I had dealt with recently with the district court. And, you know, the judge, well, this fellow's in Springfield now, but also I understand from Judge Solomon that he can be out in a minute with a writ. I don't understand all the legal stuff, but the point is that he didn't feel he could assist. At least I understood that to be his interpretation, that he couldn't assist in his own defense because he wouldn't participate in defending himself. Then I wonder if a person has the right to not defend himself.
Perhaps the question ought to be this. Under this language, would you get a different answer in a given case between what it is now and this language here? Would you have more or less or the same number of defendants that in your opinion you would say yes, he is able to assist, or no, he isn't able to assist? I'm sure all of you have had quite a bit of experience in making examinations of this sort.
Can you think of any that you have made that would turn out differently under this language?
Is unable or
I don't think that I can, because I mean this is essentially the language, except for item three that I already used in reporting to the court. You can probably make a determination one way or the other, and this is the way I'll say it, particularly the language.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, 1, 2, and 4.
Yeah.
The language from sub 3 comes from the California, or I guess the whole thing comes from California draft.
Yes, I think it's found elsewhere, but I can't tell you. I wish I had brought the Michigan draft with me. I think it's there also. Proposed Michigan Penal Code, but I don't have that, so I better not make that statement. I would reply to John. Certainly, I don't think it was my intent, nor do I believe it was the intent of the subcommittee to expand with the purpose of finding people incompetent, that is, to expand the nature of the examination. The purpose was to make clear what the court needed to know from the psychiatrist within the presently existing concepts of what incompetence with respect to aiding his counsel means. Now, if it now appears that sub 3 would expand this, that's beyond, I think, the intent of the subcommittee and certainly the draftsman.
I think perhaps does it expand upon the existing law, because the existing law merely says, refers to the ability to understand the nature of the proceedings against him, and the second is to be able to assist and cooperate with his counsel and his defense.
It does not have it there, does it?
Mm-hmm. Apparently the Michigan draft doesn't.
Well, that was the...
It was based in... The California draft does have it. So.
And
perhaps we don't need subsection 3 then.
I felt, Mr. Chairman, that it possibly added a new dimension which would just complicate situations.
Well, it can be construed that way.
Yeah. The other question that I had I'm kind of fond of the present language which we have, which prefaces the meat of this by saying, if before or during the trial in any criminal case the court has reasonable ground to believe, et cetera, et cetera. We specifically define when and under what circumstances this particular section can be invoked. But here we say a person cannot be proceeded against while he is incompetent as defined in this section. So the question is, because of that, is the district attorney, for example, proscribed from filing an information of felony or taking it to the grand jury? Could say that it be an issue that could be immediately raised on a habeas corpus because of lack of definition here, where under the present state of the law there's no question that you can file an information, you can get an indictment, and then the steps are built right in there. So George, could you, if I may, Mr. Chairman, could I ask Professor Platt to direct comments to that?
I think that subject was not discussed in the subcommittee, was it? Jeff?
Well, as I recall...
I can't recall what it was.
As I recall, the answer to that was that I believe this is the answer. Maybe I'm mistaken, and I don't recall just where the minutes would be, but sections 12 and 13, I think, would make it clear that the determination, there has to be a determination, and therefore the determination is made by the court and it has to be brought to the court's attention. Presumably, usually by one of the parties, or conceivably when the defense in open court. But until a determination is made, then the proceeding continues. And I don't recall I'm sure we didn't intend to create jurisdictional problems along the way. Once the determination is made by the court, pursuant to 12 and 13, then if he finds his he's not able to proceed, why then the proceedings screech to a halt?
Well, you have a built-in, the Model Penal Code has a built-in safeguard because, again, it uses language that a person can't be tried, convicted, or sentenced. But it doesn't have any proscription against, or a proscription insofar as proceeding against that person, you see, such as we have.
What is wrong with using the Model Penal Code language here?
Tried, convicted, and sentenced?
It's in the blue page of 38. I mean, you were saying essentially the same thing, that we're removing the ambiguity.
Yeah, I see very well the issue you're raising, and I don't think we came to grips with it. I think it's a good point. Here again, there was no intent to expand in this area, and I think perhaps you're right that this language does. Your anti-aircraft gun is working very well, John, on my language.
Guy,
I think you're right.
You shot me down on arson.
I think we're becoming anti-flak experts here, aren't we?
Okay.
The Model Penal Code language speaks in terms of tried, what was that language?
Tried, convicted, or sentenced.
That may be a little more restrictive than the current law, because this would seem to say that you've got to be at trial before you can raise the issue of incompetence. And clearly, and under our law, this issue may be raised prior to the time the trial starts.
Correct.
I think that I see no reason at all for changing the language merely to incorporate that first part of the existing statute and thereby carrying forward the existing procedure. Would that satisfy you?
I would agree.
So it would read a person, let's see.
Well, if at any time, before or during the trial.
It would take some rephrasing, but anyhow, you want to retain the before or during trial concept that now exists in the statute. And you want to not only retain the concept, but the language. Well, I think that could be done, and I see, unless there's some objection to that, I think it'd probably be a good idea.
Me too. As I recall, Don, why don't you brief us on what the minutes were on that?
Well, at the subcommittee meeting on October 31st, in discussing Section 11 as it appeared in preliminary draft number 3, you had it set out in two subsections, one relating to sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
So the discussion largely was directed towards subsection 2, as you appeared in that, but the action that was taken by the subcommittee was to delete subsection 2 and then to restructure that section. But as far as the policy behind those, what now appears as sub 3 and sub 4, there wasn't any particular discussion in the minutes.
As I recall, at the time of the subcommittee, the thing we talked about was to
are these yours or mine?
Avoid changing existing law on sentencing, because we felt that the word sentencing in the Model Penal Code provision would possibly be productive of delay, that there are adequate protections under existing law for preventing the sentencing of persons who were not mentally capable. And as I recall, that's why we took out subsection 2, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember that we happened upon it.
No, we didn't talk about it. No,
sure. Why don't you go ahead and make that change, apparently.
I think it should go ahead.
So that we continue existing law more specifically. Are there any other comments or suggestions on either 11 or on the implementing 12 and 13, which essentially contain the details of what examination is to take place when his fitness to proceed or fitness to defend is drawn into question. See, we have one section in here provides for a reasonable fee if the examination is conducted by a psychiatrist in private practice. Call that the examination.
That leaves me out.
I'm in.
We have a cost of living factor.
In regard to this, perhaps this is a time, if I may, hark back to section 7. In the first paragraph in there, I wondered if this would be deemed as an instruction by the court. The last sentence, upon filing of notice, the court in its discretion may order the defendant committed to a state institution
or any other suitable facility for observation and examination.
What page, Doctor?
Page 17, top.
16, starting to
my concern is that if you do it on a strictly dollars and cents cost for the county, often these evaluations can be done at less expense in the patient's home community, rather than remanding the patient for, it says not more than 30 days, but that means 30 days to the state hospital, that the cost of such a stay in a state institution will often far exceed what the evaluation could be done for monetarily within the community.
Well, of course, this provides for other suitable facilities, and it says not to exceed 30 days. It could be a week, 3 days, anything.
Well, there are very few suitable facilities. There's one psychiatric department in Multnomah.
I think the subcommittee did dwell on this very problem and let the language stand in light of the practice that often in Multnomah County, the defendant is sent to the office of a psychiatrist for examination, that this is a suitable facility within the concept of this draft, and certainly the subcommittee did not want to increase the cost to the state of these kind of exams. It wanted to continue the informal practice where a court says you go down to Dr. Jones's office at 10 o'clock in the morning, he's going to examine you.
Or, I think if this is done in fact, but frequently in Multnomah County this does not happen.
Or alternatively, to provide that where the examination still ought to be conducted in Multnomah County, but would take more than simply a couple of hours in the office, commitment, let's say, to the Holiday Park or up on the hill when they get the facility established up there, because it is a severe expense factor to Multnomah County. I just got the figures the other day, showed in the fiscal 67 to 68, it cost Multnomah County for examinations of this type about $65,000 for 1 year.
We've had a number of exams that we've done at the clinic where they've been in the county jail and have been transported out. And these have been exams that have gone over a period of four, five, six visits before we could really come to some kind of conclusion.
That's a question I'd like to ask, Mr. Chairman, before the doctors get away. I have found, particularly now that I'm defending these people instead of prosecuting them, that it's highly unsatisfactory to send a psychiatrist out to Rocky Butte to examine them. I feel, and that's why I invariably recommend or move the court and strongly urge that they be committed to a suitable facility where the doctors can see them for a period of time. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but can you conduct an adequate and satisfactory examination of a man by going out to Rocky Butte and interviewing him for an hour?
Not for an hour, and you might, although it's not really as satisfactory as it would be otherwise. I have never done that, but we've had a number of people in the county jail who have come to the clinic and have come with a matron and, you know, or with the police officer and somebody else, and that I've seen maybe four or five times in the clinic. I don't think the physical setting is that important, provided that there's some privacy and there's some comfort for both parties so that you can sit down and, you know, and talk with each other. And but I've always done it in the office, and they've brought me
on. Two or three or four times.
Yeah, that's
implicit in your answer is that you have to see him more than once. Is that right?
You almost invariably, unless it's for a specific question like the proceeding, you know, whether they're going to, whether they're capable of participating, have the capacity to participate in their own defense and so forth. Whereas just one specific question, then usually an hour. But where it's the whole ball of wax, maybe 3 or 4 hours, 2 or 3 hours. Some murder cases we've spent 3 or 4 hours, and I've had a couple of other people on the staff examine the patient. So it varies in the individual case.
I see.
In my own experience, which I guess is somewhat different than Dan's, I've done it lots of ways. I've gone out to the Butte, and this makes me personally very uncomfortable. This is my idea of a prison, and I don't like the environment, so I don't do that anymore. Preferable to that, it's easy to arrange for the patient to be taken to the downtown jail. And this, from my viewpoint, is far preferable. Occasionally, I've seen him at the office, and occasionally, I've had him admitted to Holiday Park Hospital. Now, that's been particularly true of counties other than Multnomah. Each of these has its advantages, and I think the cases vary sufficiently that there are those cases where in one visit of an hour and a half to 2 hours, I feel I can reach an adequate conclusion about this prisoner. And there are just as many more where I want to come back again once or twice, or where I want to have that patient admitted to a facility where I can do a physical and neurological exam too and get an EEG and a brain scan if it's any good.
Where
but there are cases where you can, in short order, make up your mind.
Where at the courthouse jail do you do that?
It varies. Sometimes just right there in those the open row. The cells across from the main lockup. And then they have provided a room way back yonder, around a corner someplace. But frankly, it's usually so dusty and dirty that I just assume to it out front. So, you know, I think you can...
Where did you at the Butte?
In the patient's own cell, I believe. I've only been out there twice, and that did it. I just don't like the place. I feel very locked up out there and forgotten.
When I went out there, the
this is the erotic center, and they come most of it.
So forth in that.
You gotta visit Dr. Voice.
It has nothing to do with the law, but I just wonder why that they're not using that room upstairs with the fireplace and carpeting on the floor. It used to be an apartment for the keeper out there. It's vacant.
That would make it more
an ideal kind of place for such as an
you have privacy.
Sure, absolutely.
Because it was very unsatisfactory where I did the review.
Well, this
I know that in conversations with Judge Bryson and Judge Salmonini, who make instant decisions in Montgomery County, that they have indicated that a very sizable number of the psychiatrists reach the same decision these gentlemen did. They just want to go out to Rocky Butte. It
takes a lot of time.
It's time to
traveling back and forth.
It was just facility. There certainly could be something done with it. Although this doesn't have much to do with our efficiency.
No, but I noticed in our minutes that we discussed this same thing we're discussing here quite fully.
Could I ask?
If you'd be here in a minute.
I'll do that, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Doctor.
Could I ask a question? And this still troubles me about Section 11. If a man we can call it a delusion, but if a man decides that he wants to get a maximum sentence and so on and so forth, maybe this doesn't have anything to do with this hearing here, but is this assisting or cooperating in his own defense? Or is the idea that he is to cooperate in terms of his contention with the state in regard to the crime?
Well, my understanding of it was to assist in his own defense, to his own advantage, as the ordinary person sees it, not someone who is depressed and has delusions, in order to help himself, to free himself. And I think that's generally the understanding of it. If he were quite the opposite, if he were what you say, I think it very well be said that he is not in condition to assist and cooperate.
Any other comments on 11, 12, or 13?
On 12, paragraph 2, under B, 3B, we come in this question about a diagnosis of the mental condition of the defendant. I wonder if Professor Platt could clarify what his, you know, what you mean by diagnosis.
We do not use it as a term of art that a psychiatrist would use. We chatted about this a little bit during the lunch hour, and I think that perhaps a less artful word, that is one that does not stir up perhaps controversy among psychiatrists as to the word diagnosis and its connotations of nomenclature would be more appropriate, because we certainly do not want to take sides in that argument. the suggestion was made by Dr. Voice that the word the finding on the mental condition of the defendant would be appropriate, and that certainly would serve the purpose for which in which the court would be interested. Just simply a word, avoiding a word that unnecessarily might cause some controversy.
Well, I wonder if the diagnosis in the classical sense, and this is where Dr. Smith and I differ, the diagnosis in the classical sense, such as saying schizophrenic reaction, is what the court would have in mind, or what the statute has in mind as being useful, or whether the findings in terms of the descriptive or phenomenological description of the behavior of the patient and why and the wherefores of the offense.
Judge, I think you're much better position to answer that.
Well, I'm trying to remember whether we wrestled this around during the subcommittee meeting or not.
This word didn't cause us any trouble because we hadn't thought of that word.
I guess perhaps we simply didn't appreciate that might be a loaded word in your terms. I think customarily when you get these reports, you want to have as full a setting out of the factors as possible. Customarily, they will, though they do not always describe the nature of the examination conducted, oftentimes they do. At least those from the state hospital will normally have the specific diagnosis using the numbers, which personally to me, I always thought it doesn't help me to know that this guy is a 30.02 or whatever the number they use, but that seems to be the way they do it.
How about a statement in plain English
yes.
of the mental condition of the defendant?
We have limited jurisdiction.
Just a description of the mental condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes it very clear.
Mm-hmm. It's all certain.
Yeah, which takes out the idea of a label.
Very clear.
It doesn't describe anything.
And if somebody does want to label it, he can label it and then go
That's
on
right.
beyond that mm-hmm. to describe what this means.
Because
I'm sure schizophrenia means very little to most courts, unless it's described and defined as a psychosis and what it does to the behavior and the judgment of the patient. Prisoner.
Statement is better than description. Description is too long. That calls for a long-winded reply. Just a statement of the mental condition of the defendant.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is it necessary? Well, maybe I've been asleep and I've been reading my minute. Is it necessary to specify what the report should contain, what the report of the examination should contain? Is it too restrictive for you to? Or maybe you want the guidelines in the statute to say it should contain this, this, or this. But I can't see where, when I move in your court for an examination under 136.150, and prescribe the way the order should read, and the order goes to the psychiatrist, you take that order before you examine the man, have in mind exactly what the court wants, and use that as the basis for your examination and your report of your examination. So why is it necessary to define this in the statute?
Well, one of the reasons was because of the great variety of the reports that are received, frankly.
Well, if the judge frames the order the way he should, in a way they do in Multnomah County, I might add.
Very carefully, Ed.
In actual practice, we never see this order. The mechanics of a court appointment consists of a phone call from Mrs. So-and-so at the district attorney's office notifying us that Judge So-and-so has appointed me to examine Mr. X, who is charged with armed robbery. And then I go see Mr. X, having arranged for it to be brought downtown. But I never see a judge's order.
You know?
Huh?
See, I do sometimes.
Well, you do
well,
from
rare,
the federal court,
rare.
Don't you? Because I had one last month.
Federal court.
And the doctor...
I think that the state hospital, they see the order. I know that at the state hospital, they customarily see the police report because that's sent down to them. I don't know if the private psychiatrists see it or not, but I know that at the state hospital, they do see the police report.
I don't proceed with any of this until I have the order, and that just comes through with complaints and some information. Oftentimes, I wind up calling either a defense attorney or a prosecuting attorney and getting more specific questions, you know, more specific information. But of course, we operate differently than Dr. Smith, as we're operating in a clinic, and so we go kind of stepwise, a little more bureaucratic.
How do they get the police reports?
What?
Who get them?
You said they received the police report?
State hospital.
Routinely.
I think we simply change that to a statement rather than diagnosis.
I think
right.
I think it's helpful to have a description of the nature of the examination because you know whether you
change that to statement.
Okay.
Peeked in through the bars or actually.
That's true.
Not out of sight.
Would it?
I don't think.